a man who is radically gifted in not only his ability to communicate, but what this man has acquired, his ability to study, to research, and to do what Dr. J. Vernon McGee once said, that is, he's able to take the cookies and bring them down low on the shelf so everyone can enjoy them. William Federer has studied and prepared hard and well and deep, so much so that there are so many things in his books. By the way, when he makes a claim or a statement, it will have a footnote. It will be cited. So you need to know that. This is great stuff to be taken away back to your college class, your high school. But when he says what he says, you need to be listening. I don't think I've known anyone speak faster. I don't know if he's going to speak fast tonight. But that comes because he is a wealth of information. I'm not going to take up any more time regarding his remarkable achievements and his influences. I mean, it goes on and on. There's a couple of pages I'm holding up right now of what he's involved in. One of the things that I'm happy to announce, because we have some students who have graduated from Regent, and I'm happy to say that he's on the board of Regent, which is a tremendous, tremendous school. So you guys get ready. Are you ready?
Yes.
Give a warm welcome to William Federer.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. God bless you. God bless you. You may be seated. Well, I want you to know how much your pastor, Jack Hibbs, inspires me and his wife, Lisa. And join me in thanking the Lord for such tremendous pastors right here in Chino Hills that's impacting the world. Well, I wrote a book on socialism, and I spoke about it before, but there's a subtitle to it. So it's Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present, and the subtitle is How the Deep State Capitalizes on Crises to Consolidate Control. And so I'm just going to jump right in. So 380 BC, Plato, he's sort of the guy who originated socialism. He writes in passing of Atlantis, this highly structured civilization on an island that sinks in the sea. And whether it existed or not, there is an island in the Mediterranean, Santorini, that's what's left of a volcano. I actually went there in college, and it's a nice, pretty tourist place. But it would have sent a tsunami, wiping out lots of civilizations. But Plato thought that Atlantis was the perfect structured society, and he considered democracy an unstructured society. Demos means people, krasi means rule. And the chief characteristic of a democracy is tolerance. Everybody tolerates each other. It's wonderful. And then they tolerate people that are a little bit off. Then they tolerate people that are a lot off, till finally they're tolerating lawlessness. And it turns into chaos. And then the people say, can't someone come along and fix this mess? And that's when some governor comes along and he says, I can fix it. I just need some emergency powers. So Plato says, last of all comes the tyrant. When he first appears above ground, he's a protector. He's full of smiles. I'm going to take away your freedoms, but I'm doing this to protect you. And then he ends up getting some more power. If any are suspected of resistance to his authority, he will have a good pretext for destroying them. And then he says, the protector, now he's standing up in the chariot of state with the reins in his hands, a tyrant absolute. And he has a mob entirely at his disposal, and he's not restrained from shedding of blood so he can destroy his political opponents. And Plato said democracy's doomed to fail because it's based on people having virtue. And if you give people a choice of giving up their life or giving up their virtue, they'll always give up their virtue to save their life. And I said, now ancient Israel's attempt to rule themselves without a king lasted a little longer because they had a big magnet in the sky called God, that they were virtuous because they were accountable to God. Athens didn't have that. By Plato's time, Athens had a bunch of fickle deities that nobody believed in anyway. Plato said if someone was born that truly had virtue, the world would crucify him. So he writes this, 380 BC. If a truly just man lived, let him die as he lived. I might add that the just man will be scourged, racked, bound, and will at last be crucified. So Plato said that this democracy is doomed to crash, and the best you can hope for is a nice tyrant. He called him a philosopher king. He's the head of gold. and his arms and chest are the administrators, and together they make up the ruling class, and everyone else is the abdomen of iron and bronze. They're the ruled class. So socialism is a structured society of a ruling class and a ruled class. The ruling class, they're above the law, they're politically connected, and they're supported by the commoners. The ruling class can do special things, like getting their hair styled when nobody else can. The ruled class, yes, they are all provided for, but no one owns any property. There's no families. The government decides who gets to have children, and the government takes the children away from the parents and brings them into the schools where they're socialized, which is a term to get them used to serving the ruling class. Plato says that when the true philosopher kings are born in a state, they will set in order their own city. They will take possession of the children, who will be unaffected by the habits of their parents. These they will train in their own habits and laws. And these children will be taught lies, noble lies. Plato said, we want one single grand lie which will be believed by everybody. So we got the people ruling themselves, but without virtue, it turns into chaos. Out of that chaos, you get a dictator. So we begin to see that there's a couple ways to take power away from the people. And so democracies and republics are forms of government that are called popular. Not popular because everybody, you know, votes for them. No, popular means populace. So the people, the population rules themselves. So democracy is everybody has to be at every meeting every day to talk about every issue, very time consuming. And since you physically have to be there, they only could be as large as a city. So the Greeks had city states. Rome was a republic. A republic is where you're in charge, but you're ruling through representatives. So you can take care of your family and farm. So republics could get bigger, but you're still in charge. So if democracies and republics have taken the power from the king, given it to the people, what if there's a king who wants to take it away from the people and reconcentrate it? So there's two ways to do this. One is fear, and the other is free stuff. So fear. People will trade freedom for security. If you get people into fear, they will give up their freedoms for the promise of security. The second is free stuff. Everybody likes free stuff, but then you get dependent on the free stuff, and then they begin to threaten to hold back, and you're hooked. You'll give up your independence. The Bible does say, the fear of the wicked, it shall come upon them. And then another verse, but every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. So you want that free stuff. Sort of like a drug dealer takes over a neighborhood two ways. The first way is he comes in with guns and he gets everybody fearful. And they panic and agree to pay the mob protection money. But the other way is the drug dealer can give away free drugs. Really free? Yeah. But then once you're hooked, he says, you want some more? You got to sell yourself into prostitution to get some money. You got to rob from your neighbor, right? And so they get you to do stuff that you'd never do before because you're hooked. It's sort of like a hunter can catch animals two ways, right? Can go out with guns, right? Or with bait, right? You lure them in. It's sort of interesting. I was reading how they catch wild pigs. And so they begin to build a little fence in the woods, and they sprinkle corn on the ground. And the pigs come up and eat the corn, and they don't mind that there's a post there. And the next day, there's two posts. The next day, there's three posts. The next day, there's four. But they just keep eating the corn. Until finally, there's a whole circle full of posts, and there's one little entryway to get in. And they just squeeze through the entryway, and they're eating the corn, and then you just close it, right? And then the pigs are trapped. And so you get people dependent on free stuff, and then finally, they let their guard down, and they get taken over. So we got free stuff, but we also have crises, fear. And so since it's natural that people give up freedom in exchange for security, there are some ambitious politicians that say, let's intentionally get people into fear. And so just a couple scriptures. Psalm 133 says, how good and pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. Everybody say unity.
Unity.
But then in Proverbs 6, it says six things the Lord hates, and the last is he that soweth discord. Everybody say discord. So we got unity, we got discord. And imagine being in heaven and somebody sows discord in heaven. His name's Lucifer. And he got a third of the angels to rebel against God. And so now the devil's down on earth, right? And so he sows discord. That's sort of his modus operandi. And one instance is Israel. Now, for 400 years, they didn't have a king. And then their first king was Saul. But about a century before Saul, they almost lost it with Abimelech. So who's he? Gideon defeats 100,000 Midianites. So Israel's at peace. There are no threats to Israel. And he has an illegitimate son named Abimelech who invents identity race politics. He goes to the town of Shechem. And he says, is it better for you that all the sons of Gideon reign over you? Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. And then it says, well, we got to vote for him because he is our brother. So forget whether he's good at ruling or not. He's one of us. So it's identity politics. And then they go to Abimelech goes to the temple of Baal-berith, and he takes 70 pieces of silver, and he hires rioters, Antifa-type people. And it says, and they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-berith, wherewith Abimelech hired vain and worthless persons which followed him. And he went unto his father's house at Ophrah, and he slew his brethren. I mean, he's just rioting with all these people. And then the men of Shechem made Abimelech king. So here it's peaceful. The 100,000 Midianites are destroyed. Israel has no threats, and he decides to sow discord. And he goes in there, takes money, hires rioters, does identity politics, and then he does violence and kills all his half-brothers. And now, the Hebrew Republic would have ended here rather than King Saul had not somebody threw a millstone over a wall and it killed Abimelech. So there you go. Well, let's skip forward in history, and Machiavelli lived 500 years ago in Italy. Italy was not Italy 500 years ago. It was a bunch of city-states, Venice, Genoa, Naples, Florence, Siena, and they always fought. And Machiavelli thought if one prince could control all of Italy, it would stop the infighting. So he writes a book called The Prince, where he advocates the ends justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end that any means necessary to get there is justified. Lie, cheat, steal. So if a prince wants to conquer a city and the city does not want to be conquered, they would hate him. But if the prince takes money, like Abimelech, and hires vain and worthless persons to riot and loot and smash windows and set buildings on fire, the people in the city will panic and they'll want somebody to come along and fix it. The prince will come in, get rid of the very criminals he bribed to create the mess. Nobody will know the better for it, and everyone will praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire, then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher, and they'll pay anything for it and even thank you for being there. So it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on a crisis to consolidate control. You know that quote a little bit more recent as you don't want a crisis to go to waste. It is an opportunity to do important things that you would otherwise avoid. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, I'm actually excited about this opportunity. We are not yet through this crisis, but the chief of staff for President Obama is an old friend of mine and my husband's, and he said, you know, never waste a good crisis. And then just last week, I saw Fox primetime Ben Domenech said, the authoritarian left is using the permanent pandemic to achieve as many ends as they can imagine. The authoritarian left, let's see, this is Rahm Emanuel's famous dictum, never let a crisis go to waste. Normal times don't produce the outcomes that the authoritarian left wants because people are not scared enough to give them the limitless power they crave. Crises are necessary, and so if there aren't any on offer, they manufacture them. So we see a crisis, our response is how can we help people through it? They see a crisis, their response is how can we usurp power through it? Henry Louis Mencken wrote in 1956, the urge to save humanity is almost always a false face for the urge to rule it. Power is what all messiahs really seek. They are not the chance to serve. Now, 33rd California governor Ronald Reagan warned, one of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism is medicine, is healthcare. It is easy to disguise a medical program as a humanitarian project. Right, everybody wants people to be healthy, and so if you don't stop this, behind it will come other federal programs that will invade every area of freedom until one day we will awake and find that we have socialism. He wrote this at a time when there was a socialist running for governor of California named Norman Thomas, and I saw this cartoon. A friend of mine, David Lane, sent it out. Dangerous new variant. It appears to be mutating into a totalitarian dictatorship. And Reagan said, we want no further encroachment on these individual liberties and freedoms. Now, we talked about, amen. We talked about Abimelech, we talked about Machiavelli, but then let's look at a couple other applications. Britain, they have the largest empire in world history, and they took over India. How? In 1714, they landed in Bengal and started a trading post that turned into a trading fort that turned into them getting involved in local politics and giving guns to one kingdom and guns to another kingdom, stirring up ancient animosities against them until they broke out in bloodshed. And then the British came in to restore order and they took control of them. And they did this again and again and again till they took over all of India, a quarter of the world's population. And they tried doing that during the American Revolution, right? They went to the Mohawk Indians. General Johnny Burgoyne comes down from Canada and incites them to scalp the Americans, right, in exchange for money. And the British did it again during the War of 1812. So the British had Pensacola, Florida, and they gave money to these and guns to these Red Stick Creek Indians to attack and butcher. You know the French pronunciation of Red Stick? Baton Rouge. Right, so that's Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So this was the Red Stick Creek Indians. And here's the historical marker. Here, Creek Indian War, 1813-14, took place the most brutal massacre in American history. Indians took the fort with heavy loss, then killed all but some 36 of the some 550 in the fort. Creeks had been armed by British at Pensacola in this phase of the War of 1812. So the British really didn't care about the Indians' issues. They were using the Indians to create this crisis so they could come in and take over the whole thing. Washington warned in his farewell address, disorders and miseries gradually incline the minds of men to seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual who turns this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. Let there be no change through usurpation. Usurpation is you're doing things you're really not authorized to do, but people let you get away with it because you've convinced them that it's for their own good. But once they get away with it, it becomes the new precedent. Sort of like playing sandlot football. You're out of bounds. No, 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 the boundary's over here. And you follow and say, okay, okay, the boundary's over there. Then the next time, you're out of bounds. No, no, the boundary's over here. Right? They keep moving it. Washington said, usurpation, though in one instance may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. So it's like, I want to do something good. I just need a little extra power temporarily. Right? The precedent of usurpation must always greatly overbalance in permanent evil any partial or transient benefit which the use of it at any time can yield. Right? So it's a short-term benefit, but a long-term evil. So we talked about the story of Lucifer sowing division in heaven and Abimelech sowing division in Israel and Machiavelli sowing division and the British sowing division to build their world empire. But now we're going to talk about Hegel. He taught at the University of Berlin. And Napoleon had just conquered Europe. 6 million people died. And the king of Prussia, Germany wasn't Germany. It was a bunch of kingdoms, Saxony, Bavaria, Prussia. And they had armies and fought. And Hegel thought if one king could rule all the German kingdoms, then there would be peace, right? Sort of like Machiavelli. So Hegel, he came up with his theory of dialectics that influenced Darwin and Karl Marx. Marx was a member of the Young Hegelians, a radical student group at the University of Berlin. So Hegel's, his dialectics is a triangle. One corner is a thesis, the opposite corner is an antithesis or antithesis, and the top corner is a synthesis. It sounds complicated, but it's not. In other words, you start off with the status quo, you create a problem that's real bad, and everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. Then that becomes the new starting point. You create another problem that's real bad, and everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. And that becomes the new starting point. Then you create another problem that's real bad, and everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. And each time they settle, the people give up a little more of their freedom, and it's reconcentrated into the hands of the state. Right? You have to get them into fear. And when people are in fear, they will trade freedom for security. So let's create a crisis. Now, how do you create this antithesis? This Karl Marx says you send in agitators, agent provocateurs, community organizers, labor organizers. Their job is to find people with grievances, stir them up to riot, and then when the whole country gets in fear and panic, then you come along promising to restore order and you usurp power. So he called it critical theory. Critical economic theory, critical racial theory. And so you would study a country and see the groups. And then you would call one victims and the other oppressors. One the haves, the other have-nots. And then you would orchestrate the protests and riots and so forth. And then when it was destabilized and fearful enough, everybody panics. And that's when they usurp power, promising to fix it. And so originally, he was organizing the proletariat against the bourgeois, which is the working class against the business owners. Or they would organize the poor against the rich, or the blacks against the whites, or the Catholics against the Protestants, or the Muslims against the Christians, even the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo and Rwanda. Sort of interesting. In Rwanda, they saw themselves as one, but when the British came in and were colonizing, they would like measure the heads and the heights of different, and they say, you're a Hutu and you're a Tutsi. They literally created racial distinctions where there was none there before. And then they stirred them up, so the one began to butcher and kill the other one. Imagine creating groups just for the sake of pitting them against each other. So Castro said in Cuba, he says, the revolution needs the enemy. The proletariat does not flee from the enemy. It needs the enemy. The revolutionary needs his antithesis, which is the counter-revolutionary. If enemies were lacking, they had to be fabricated. In other words, you can't organize your people against something if there's nothing to organize against. You got to have an enemy to organize against. And so how did this begin to come to America? You had a Pullman Railroad Car Company in Chicago. In 1894, there was a downturn in the economy, and they couldn't pay all their workers. And so Eugene Debs comes to Chicago, and he identifies groups of the factory workers and the workers, the factory owners and the workers, are have grievances, right? They're not being paid. And so he organizes them to riot, and they destroy $80 million worth of railroad cars in 27 states. Could you imagine rioting and burning going all across the country? And the entire country was brought to a standstill because the railroad shipped the mail and all the supplies and all the products. I mean, it was a supply line shortage. And then Eugene Debs started the Socialist Party of America. And he ran for president five times between 1900 and 1920. One time he ran from prison. And then in 1920, branching off of the Socialist Party of America is the Communist Party USA. And they run candidates for president every year from 1920 to 1940. What happened in 1940? That's when Democrat President Franklin Roosevelt made a treaty with Stalin during World War II. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And so the Communist Party USA said, why should we run our own candidate when here we have Democrat candidates that are making treaties with the socialists? And so from that time on, they began to infiltrate that party and try to the other party and to some extent. And remember Ronald Reagan? He said, I didn't leave the Democrat Party. The Democrat Party left me. All right, so this is when they began to come in. And now let's go across the ocean to Germany again. And so we talked about Lucifer sowing discord in heaven, Abimelech sowing discord, Machiavelli sowing discord. We talked about the British sowing discord to take over India and these different countries. And we just got done talking about Eugene Debs and his discord. And now we're going to talk about Germany. 1920s and 30s, they have a republic. The people are ruling through their elected representatives, and somebody starts a political party in Germany. His name's Hitler, and the name of his party is the National Socialist Workers' Party. You know it as Nazi. Nazi stands for Nationalarbeiter, which is the German word for worker, Socialistisch Party. And he has a sort of a violent arm to his party. Sort of like Abimelech hired vain and worthless persons, like Machiavelli paid people to create the rioting. And his were called brown shirts. And they were nicknamed Sturmabteilung, which means stormtroopers, because they would storm into the meetings of Hitler's opponents and shout down the speakers and disrupt the meeting and leave it in chaos. And then the brown shirts would lock arms and block buildings and block access to buildings and block streets. Could you imagine people locking arms and blocking streets? And then they went into the cities and they smashed windows and looted and set on fire over 7,000 stores owned by Jews in the night of broken glass, Kristallnacht. And then their capital got set on fire. It was an insurrection. And Hitler's people that did it, yet he used the chaos of the crises to falsely accuse his political opponents and have them hunted down and have them arrested and have them put in jail and prison indefinitely and have them falsely accused and have them shot without a trial. And when the dust settled, Hitler didn't have any political opponents left. And Germany transitioned from a republic to a dictatorship, right? So the same way, you know, Abimelech hired vain and worthless persons, Machiavelli, right? And the British wanted to stir up the Indians. And so here you got Hitler's brown church creating the crisis, and then he comes along promising to fix it. And I thought this was sort of interesting. Tucker Carlson showed this video of a security camera at the Capitol. And like 16 people that are the first ones in the Capitol, all dressed in black with tactical gear on them. And doesn't look like they were spontaneous people at a Trump rally, right? And so then he says, organizers and chairs almost certainly were FBI operatives, according to Tucker Carlson. Isn't that interesting? So they do something called blame shifting, which Sigmund Freud coined the term. It's where rude and hateful people call everyone they don't like rude and hateful. We've all met someone like that, right? Little kids do it. I'm not the mean one, you're the mean one. So it's called blame shifting. Karl Marx says, accuse others of what you do. It's gotten into politics, where they do the hateful thing and they accuse you of being hateful. They do the intolerant thing, they accuse you of being intolerant, right? They project their negative qualities onto you. Let's say there's a candidate running for president colluding with Russia, giving away a fifth of the U.S. uranium when their Secretary of State, in exchange for $145 million Russian oligarch donations to her Clinton Foundation. Then she wants to pay for a Steele dossier to accuse her opponent of colluding with Russia. And the investigation process is simply to subpoena and get all the information that could convict her and destroy it. Destroy laptops and hard drives and text messages and cell phones and so forth. And let's say there's another candidate that's extorting Ukraine, saying, stop investigating my son or I will hold back billions of U.S. dollars to your country. Well, you want to accuse your opponent of extorting Ukraine and even have an impeachment trial, right? You accuse them of exactly what you're doing. Why? Because they have to back up. Their name's associated with it in the media. And if they ever, people, if it ever gets pointed back at them, by that time, the water is muddied. The public does not know who to trust, and they get a pass. So so let's look at after World War II. Is this interesting?
Yes.
After World War II, I know it's difficult to clap because it's not that encouraging of a message. But so after World War II, Germany and France and England give independence to their former colonies. And so now you have brand new countries. India is now free from Britain, and so they have their own country, and they elect their own leaders. Egypt becomes its own country, and Jerusalem, Israel, right? That comes, has its, and then Albania, Bulgaria, Hungary, Lithuania, Poland, all these brand new countries with brand new leaders, and they're climbing out of the post-World War II crisis, and it looks hopeful, except the KGB decides to send agents into these countries and do critical theory, where they would observe all the different groups and begin to divide the people up. Ethnically, Bosnian, Croat, Serbs. Religiously, Sunni, Shia, Orthodox. Economically, racially, it doesn't matter. They would organize them into haves and have-nots, victims and oppressors, and they would orchestrate protests that they would escalate into riots and violence and bloodshed. Why bloodshed? Because once blood is shed, people are emotionally upset, and they don't want to sit down and rationally talk about it. So you get them into the realm of emotion, then you can manipulate them very easily because they're in fear. It's called fear-mongering. It's a literal tactic that is used. And then they would co-opt the media with bribes and threats to blame the new leader of the new country for all of these problems. And then they would nurture weak links in the military. And when the country gets panicky enough with all the riots and violence, they would do a coup or a rigged election, replace the leader with a Soviet puppet. The violence would suddenly stop. Everybody would have a breather until they realized they just gave up the farm. And now they're ruled by a Soviet puppet. 45 countries fell to communism this way. It's called behind the Iron Curtain. Now, at the same time, it's going on in China, and you have Mao Zedong. He does a little tweak on it. Instead of doing the crises so that you can usurp power, Mao Zedong came up with the concept of a continuous revolution, a continuous crisis, like a continuous pandemic, right? You want to milk this thing for all it's worth. You want to keep the people in fear. And now, Truman does nothing when these countries are falling to behind the Iron Curtain or when China is going the wrong direction, and because he thought the United Nations that he helped form at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco would bring world peace. Well, the next president is Eisenhower, and he can either sit back and let these countries fall to the communists or do something about it. Eisenhower said, the United Nations has seemed to be two distinct things to the two worlds divided by the Iron Curtain. To the free world, it seems that it should be a constructive forum. To the communist world, it has been a sounding board for their propaganda, a weapon to be exploited in spreading disunity and confusion. So, 1953, Iran sides with the Soviet Union and nationalizes the oil industry. And you're like, well, big deal, Iranian oil. Oh, wait a second. Britain has no oil fields. So in 1908, Britain formed the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. You know it better as BP. And so Iran takes BP, the Iranian Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Britain has no oil. It's got an oil shortage. So they appeal to Eisenhower for help. And Eisenhower approves the first CIA operation to overthrow a country's leader. It's Operation Ajax. And the CIA operative on the ground is Kermit Roosevelt Jr., the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt. And he's an expert in foreign languages. He goes to Tehran, and he does the same thing in reverse. He recruits mobsters and gangsters and radical imams, and he stages protests and riots, and they attack mosques, and co-opts the media with bribes and threats to blame the leader, Mossadegh, for all the problems, and nurtures weak links in the military. And when the country gets panicky enough, they go in, put Mossadegh under house arrest, lock him away for the rest of his life where he dies, and they replaced him with the Shah, who loved America and did have a rightful claim to the throne. And the CIA did the same thing in 1954, and the same thing in the Congo in 1960, Dominican Republic, Brazil, Chile, 1973, and the KGB did the same thing, with Brezhnev helping Yasser Arafat to bring division in the Middle East, and Brezhnev helping Castro to take over Cuba, and hundreds of coup attempts in Latin South America and in Africa. This is called the Cold War. And these tactics have been perfected and perfected and perfected. And we saw a co-opting of different federal departments under the term of President Obama. And so the IRS began to be used for political purposes with Lois Lerner targeting conservative organizations. And then the NSA began to target political opponents of that administration and so forth. And we're beginning to see that happen in other different federal departments. Now, Chris Matthews, I thought it was interesting. His last time on television is after a Democrat primary debate, and some of the candidates were talking about socialism. He says, I remember the Cold War. I've seen what socialism is like, and I don't like it, okay? It's not only not free, it doesn't work. I believe if Castro and the Reds had won, there would have been executions in Central Park. After that, he was relieved of his employment. And so Castro executions, he had an executioner named Che Guevara. So Che Guevara wrote a letter and he says, we executed many people by firing squad without knowing if they were fully guilty. I'd like to confess, I discovered that I really like killing. Blind hate against the enemy, this is Che Guevara, creates a forceful impulse that cracks the boundaries of natural human limitations, transforming the soldier into an effective, selective, cold killing machine. A people without hate cannot triumph. Right? So we talk about loving and forgiving. The gospel says, you know, turn the other cheek, love those, pray for those that despitefully use you. This is opposite of that. And anyway, now another tactic is economic. And so Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto, 1848. And then they said this, that they were alchemists of the revolution. Their business consists in spurring it into artificial crises. And Friedrich Engels, every new crisis must be more serious and more universal than the last. Every fresh slump must ruin more small capitalists. This will increase the number of the unemployed, and in the end, commercial crises will lead to a social revolution. So socialism, remember Plato? It's the ruling class and the ruled class. There's no place for a middle class. The middle class are the only ones that can pool their money and challenge the ruling class. So they want to get rid of the middle class. So when Lenin took over in Russia, he killed all the kulak farmers. They were the wealthy middle class. And he wrote to his men, don't just kill them, but hang them up in the town square and P.S. get tougher men. Stalin killed the middle class, and we began to see this. And so when Stalin is in charge of Russia in 1934, this cartoon editorial is in the Chicago Tribune. Plan of action for the U.S. Spend, spend, spend under the guise of recovery. Bust the government, blame the capitalists for the failure, junk the Constitution, and declare a dictatorship. On the side, it says it worked in Russia. So spend, spend, spend under the guise of recovery. What's that? That's trillion-dollar stimulus programs and infrastructure programs that are not intended to stimulate. It is called the Great Reset, where you totally spend, spend, spend until all the money is worthless and everybody's savings evaporates, and you have all these people, especially older people that are on fixed income. What are they going to do? They're going to go to the government and say, help. The government says, okay, we'll help you. And they're going to give them stuff. But then they're going to say, okay, you want to continue to get this stuff? You've got to get this shot. You got to do that. You got to do this. You got to do that, right? It's like the drug dealer gets them hooked. So it's a back door into socialism. So again, two ways to take over socialism. You can come in with tanks and shoot, or you can bankrupt it until everybody is dependent on the government. It's called the Cloward-Piven strategy. But we began to see some of that during the Great Depression. And everybody goes to the government for help, and FDR is happy to help. But in exchange, people give up their freedoms. David Horowitz, a former communist, now a conservative writer, said, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. Civil rights, women's rights is never the real cause. Women, blacks are only instruments in the larger cause, which is power. Battles over rights and other issues, according to Alinsky, should never be seen as more than occasions to advance the real agenda, which is the accumulation of power. So the people that are down at the street, I love those on-the-street interviews. They interview some kid. Why are you here at this riot? I don't know. I got a text invisible from my professor. Said I get extra credit if I show up and start smashing windows and stuff. You know, but Lenin called them useful idiots. And now this was interesting. Do I still have your attention? So in 1980, a communist defects. His name's Yuri Bezmenov. He comes to America, and he spills the beans. He says, people think of KGB like James Bond. He goes, nah, it's pretty simple. All we do, we study groups. We do critical theory. We study all the different groups and find out which ones we can pit against which ones. And he said that it's a demoralizing period, and they also want to identify public opinion molders. Right? Because you want to sway the people. So you got to get in charge of the people that are molding in the media, in education, and the pulpit. And he says, this is a 20-year period. You invite them to your parties. You invite them to your rich clubs. And they all want to be friends. And you pull them in a socialist direction. And he says, it's so effective. When kids go through this education, you can take them to a Soviet torture prison camp. And they won't believe their own eyes. He says, then the next phase is a destabilizing phase where you get the company to spend, spend, country to spend, 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 right, under the guise of recovery. You get them to waste money on infrastructure and bankrupt them. Then the next is a crisis that you blow out of proportion, fan across the country, get everybody to panic, and then you do your coup or your rigged election. And then there's a normalization. Everybody gets used to the new norm of not having the freedoms they had before. And now the infiltrating of the churches, I thought it was interesting. A congressman named Albert Hurlong, Florida, in 1963, read a list of 45 tactics of the communists. And one of them was infiltrate the churches, right? They're a public opinion molder, and replace revealed religion with social religion. So somebody that lived through this was Manning Johnson, a black man who became a communist and after 10 years realized that they didn't want to help his community. They were just using him to sow division and crises. So he leaves them. He writes a book called Color Communism and Common Sense, and it's free on the internet, but you can also buy my book, and it's got all that in there. And Archibald Roosevelt, the son of Teddy Roosevelt, wrote the foreword to the book. And he talks about how the communists first tried doing what they did in Russia, right? They go into the schools, make the kids spit on the Bible and kick the Bible. But he says the minority community in America was too attached to the Bible. They couldn't get anywhere with telling them to forget the Bible. And so he says that they decided to change the gospel. He says the new line went like this. Jesus, the carpenter, was a worker like the communists. He was against the money changers, the capitalists, the exploiters of that day. That is why he drove them from the temple. Communists are the modern day fighters against capitalists or money changers. If Jesus were living today, he would be persecuted like communists. Right? So forget the fact we're all sinners going to hell and Jesus, the only begotten Son of God, died on the cross to pay for our sins. No, he was just an activist. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who spent 11 years in gulag camps, said, I call upon America to be more careful with its trust. Prevent those from falsely using the struggle for social justice to lead you down a false road. Now we're getting a little closer to home. Saul Alinsky, he's in Chicago with Al Capone's hitmen, Frank Nitti. And Al Capone and Saul Alinsky saw that all they had to do was shoot a few people, smash a few windows, and the whole neighborhood would get in fear and trade freedom for security and agree to pay the mob protection money. And so he decided to apply it to politics. And he says the first step of community organization is community disorganization. Right? Satan sowed discord in heaven, Abimelech sowed discord, Machiavelli sowed discord, the British came in to sow discord, Hegel talked about this, and Karl Marx. He says, disruption of the present organization is the first step. The organizer's first job is to create the issues or the problems. The organizer must first rub raw the resentments of the people of the community. An organizer must stir up dissatisfaction and discontent, fan the latent hostilities of many of the people to the point of overt expression. The organizer polarizes the issue, helps lead his forces into conflict. For he must search out controversy, for unless there is controversy, the people are not concerned enough to act. Now, I thought it was amazing that Saul Alinsky put an acknowledgement in the front page of his book, and I got a copy of the book, to Lucifer. This is it. Lest we forget, at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement to the first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment, did it so effectively, he at least won his own kingdom, Lucifer. The strategy, the tactics we've been seeing taking place in America of the intentional going in, sowing discord, breaking people, critical theory, break people into groups, pit them against each other, haves and have-nots, right? So we see these happening. I spoke in Emporia, Kansas, right? They told me that they were going to have a peaceful protest, and somebody dropped a pallet of bricks off right where they were going to have a peaceful protest. They said there was no construction going on in the whole entire area. And the people put up enough stink that they stopped this peaceful protest. And we began to see pallets of bricks were dropped off in Dallas, dropped off. They were dropped off all around the country. Either the NSA, with all of their ability, is totally clueless that they could this takes a lot of organization. Or they were turning a blind eye, or worse, they could have been complicit. So anyway, and there are some areas where the people would not riot, and so they would import people that have a predisposition to rioting. Anyway, so let's look at the COVID response. The first thing was let criminals out of jail. Really? You couldn't figure out something else to do? And then crime goes up in the big cities. And some people feel unsafe in the big cities and they move out. Who moves out? Well, maybe those with families. Certainly those that can afford to move out. Okay, a little better off economically, pro-family. They tend to belong to one political party. Who's left in the city? Well, more people dependent on government entitlements. They tend to belong to the other political party. And then businesses are closed and looted and allowed to be vandalized and police defunded. And so pro-business people move out of these big cities. Well, they tend to belong to that first political party. And then churches are shut down where pro-life social conservatives gather. And then schools are closed where kids that have been indoctrinated with Hate America, Howard Zinn, 1619 Project, they're free to riot. The net COVID response was more people of one political party move out of the big cities, leaving the other party with monopoly control over city politics. And in presidential election years, whoever wins the big city wins the state. You can do voter fraud if you want. Nobody from the other party is there to watch. And whoever wins the state gets all the electoral votes for the state. And the president is elected by electoral votes. It's a clear political advantage to one party by the COVID response and letting crime go up in the big cities. So, again, I just thought I'd come and give you a little encouragement tonight and, you know, lift you up. And I have something where I talk about deconstruction, where it's a socialist tactic where you say negative things about a country's past to get people emotionally detached from it. Then you get them into the neutral where they don't remember where they came from, and then you portray whatever future you have for them positively. It's a sales technique. If I was a toothpaste salesman, the first thing I do is I tell you negative things about the toothpaste you're currently using. You're still brushing with that stuff, haven't you? Read it'll eat the enamel off your teeth. You're like, ew. You're repulsed by it. Now I got you in a neutral. You're open-minded. What are all the toothpaste out there? And then I give you my pitch for this brand new tartar control breath freshener toothpaste. So it's a drive neutral. It's a gene editing program for a culture. Take out the old memory history and you put in the new. And so that's what they do. They go into the classroom, tell the kids negative things about the founders, took land from Indians, sold people into slavery. They were chauvinist. Students were repulsed by them. Now, forget the fact that our founders gave us a form of government where you get to be in charge of your life. Forget that. And so these kids are repulsed by it. Now you got the kids in a neutral. Then you can brainwash them and give them a positive pitch for LGBT or Islam or socialism. And Europe went through this. It went from a Judeo-Christian Europe with 1,000 years of Catholic cathedrals, Protestant Reformation, Jewish neighborhoods to a secular Europe. With the French Revolution, free sex, anything goes, now it's turning into a Sharia socialist Europe. And then they tore down statues in France during the French Revolution. Good King Henry IV, and they dug up the bones of St. Genevieve, who got all of Paris to fast and pray so Attila would skip the sack in the city. But it's not just Western civilization. China did it. 3rd century BC, the Warring States period. 6 kingdoms fighting, 1 wins, led by Qin Shi Huangdi. And Qin Shi Huangdi was being criticized for doing things differently than they had been done before. And he got tired of being criticized, so he decided to destroy all records of how things were done before. And he burnt tens of thousands of bamboo annal books. So in Egypt, they wrote on papyrus reeds. In China, they wrote on strips of bamboo from top to bottom, and they wove them together. And he just burnt thousands of them. And his chancellor, Li Si, wrote in 213 B.C., I, your servant, propose that all historians' records other than those of Qin's be burned. If anyone under heaven has copies of the classics of history, they shall deliver them to the governor for burning. Anyone who dares discuss the classics of history shall be publicly executed. Anyone who uses history to criticize the present shall have his family executed. And anyone who has failed to burn the books after 30 days of this announcement will be sent to build a great wall. So this is an intentional cutting ties of the past. So they can do their new people's whatever it was. So Mao Zedong did the same thing in the 1960s, 70s. It's called the Cultural Revolution, where he destroyed thousands of years of Chinese history. And they did something called white shaming. So they'd bring anybody that was a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher that had been educated, like with Western education, they would bring them in and cut them and they'd bleed. And the more blood that these young kids could have on their uniforms, the more they considered they were loyal to the revolution. He destroyed the oldest Buddhist temple in China. He destroyed the great gates of Beijing. And this is just a recent article. So Paris was going to have an exposition on Genghis Khan. For those not familiar, Genghis Khan was Mongolian who conquered China in the 1200s. And his son Kublai Khan ran it to what's called the Yuan Dynasty. And it was the largest contiguous empire in world history. Yes. It went from Korea to Hungary to Russia. But it's considered an embarrassment to the Chinese because, you know, Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan were Mongolian. And so here they decide to erase Genghis Khan from Chinese history. You're just going to erase the largest contiguous land empire in world history. So in Paris, they were going to have an exhibition. He calls them, says, cancel it. They can't. And they're tearing down and trashing monuments to Genghis Khan in the areas around Mongolia. And Pol Pot does the same thing in Cambodia. Khmer Rouge. And he decided that 1975 was the new year zero, and anything prior to that was irrelevant, and he killed anybody that wore glasses. If you wore glasses, you could read. If you read, you knew the history. And he kills a third of his country. And Sharia Islam does the same thing. They come into a country, they destroy the libraries, the artwork, the museum. And anyway, and they're still doing it today. The great, and this is a socialist who died in prison in Italy, Antonio Gramsci. He says, you can't defeat America on the battlefield, but so you have to rot them from within. And so it's called the long march through the institutions. It's going to take a long time, but we're going to rot every single area. He says the civilized world has been thoroughly saturated with Christianity for 2,000 years. Any country grounded in Judeo-Christian values cannot be overthrown until those roots are cut. Socialism is precisely the religion that must overwhelm Christianity. In the New World Order, socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of schools, universities, churches, and the media by transforming the consciousness of society. And anyway, I go into 1984, George Orwell and everything, but I'm running out of time. So but you can come back tomorrow and I'll talk about some more stuff. So how's that? I do want to end with one thought, and I don't know if I have a nice slide to end it on, but but anyway, I'll talk. So we are at church, and so we do want to get some spiritual message out. And you know, so I said a lot of history. There's about 6,000 years of recorded human history, all the way back to its cuneiform in the Mesopotamian Valley. And kings are the most common form of governments. You got Israel for 400 years, did not have a king. That was an anomaly, and America's founders looked back to that to set up our form of government. But you see there's pharaohs and Caesars and Kaisers, sultans, czars, and as the centuries go on, these kingdoms get bigger and bigger and bigger because of military advancements. They can kill more people, and with technological advancements, they can track more people. So instead of killing with a rock, they kill with a bronze weapon or an iron weapon or a phalanx spear or a scimitar sword or a composite bow or whatever. So the weapon changes. But the British had the biggest empire in world history, but it didn't stop with them, right? There is a goal the devil came to Jesus and says, bow down and worship me, and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world because they're mine to give, and I give them to whoever I want. It's like, whoa, that's pretty audacious. When did you get them? When Adam sinned. So Adam was in charge of the garden. We know that because he named everything. Naming implies authority over. But the Bible says, to whomever you yield your members servants to obey, to him you are a servant. The moment Adam obeyed Satan, he was posturing himself as the obeyer, and the devil is being in charge, and the devil usurped that power. And all these kingdoms of the world, how do they run? They run through fear. That's the electricity that motivates them. Ancient Israel's model switched, and it was run bottom up, where the people had virtue, had morals. And so we got this 6,000 years of history, but we see it from our point of view. And God chose for us to be alive right now. But let's pause for a moment and look at it from God's point of view. Here's God. He exists for eternity. Eternity upon eternity upon eternity. We have no idea of knowing how long that is. He's always existed. And he is all powerful. It's not that he knows everything. It's impossible for him not to know everything. And everything he makes follows rules. Laws of planetary motion, laws of gravity, laws of physics, laws of quantum, subatomic particle, law, everything's laws. He is a God of laws. He is just. Yes, sir. And, I was looking at the Hubble telescope YouTube video. So in 2004, they focused the Hubble telescope on a little spot in the sky. The spot was so small, if you were to take a grain of sand and hold it between your fingers at arm's length against the night sky, that's how tiny of a spot they focused the Hubble telescope on for 11 days. And when they developed the images in that little spot where there was nothing, was 10,000 galaxies with 100 billion stars in each one. And because light travels in waves, with blue being the fastest and red the slowest, they saw the red shift. And so that means these galaxies are moving away from us. And because of the parallax system where they look at the stars, but the earth is going around the sun. So as the earth moves, you get to see the stars from different angles. You can see if they move, they can tell how far away they are. So these galaxies are 47 billion light years away. And it blows all the astronomers' minds. And then they look over here and they pick other spots where there's nothing and they look at it. And it's 47 billion, 93 billion light years across is the observable universe, and it's still expanding at the speed of light. And the largest star they found is Stevenson 2-18. It is a super gas giant. If you were to place Stevenson 2-18 in our solar system, it would engulf the orbit of Saturn, the sixth planet from the sun. We're the third planet from the sun. Could you imagine one star that big? Here is God. He makes everything. He is all powerful. What could you possibly offer that being? But what's a galaxy anyway? It's a bunch of rocks. Big rocks, small rocks, enormous rocks, vaporized rocks. A rock cannot love you. So at some point in eternity past, God said, I would really like someone in my image that could love me. Now it gets interesting because love, by definition, must be voluntary. The moment it's forced, it evaporates. The moment God would force you and overly influence you to love him, he himself would know that he's forcing you to love him, and he would know that your response is not a pure love response. So in this framework of everything massive that he controls, he created one itsy bitsy little thing that he does not control, your will. Now, he could control it if he wanted to, but that would defeat the whole purpose of him making us, right? But he created this. So in other words, he hides himself behind creation, because if he ever revealed himself in all of his awesome, incomprehensible power, every atom in your being would fall flat and worship him, and he would not know if you're worshiping him because he is so totally and completely awesomely powerful.
That's right.
Or because you made a willful decision to love him.
Yeah, exactly.
I use the example of a billionaire has a son who goes to college. And he drives up in his Maserati, Lamborghini, Porsche, right? He's got his gold rings, Rolex watch, fanciest clothes. He's decked out. He's going to have every girl on campus wanting to meet him. But if he lays all that aside and he comes to campus driving an old clunker, he's got holes in his jeans, the uppity girls are going to ignore him. But then there's some girl that likes to study with him in the library. They get to become friends. She gets ridiculed by the clique for hanging around him, but she loves him. They get engaged, and then he says, I want to take you back to meet my dad. And they're like driving up to this castle mansion estate, and this girl's like, whoa, you didn't tell me about all this. He knows that she loves him for him, not because of all of his stuff. The God of time, the God of history creates all this, but then he created this plan of redemption, this plan that you can have a relationship, and he will not force you. He even gives you the grace to choose him. It's a magnetic pull. He's pulling you. You know, I was thinking of my credit card. It has no battery in it, but it has a little chip. You go to the grocery store, you got all your items, you plug the little card in that chip reader, and it sends a signal. And all that little chip has to do is respond.
Yeah.
And the transaction is made.
Yeah,
but if that chip is damaged, if it hardens its heart and doesn't respond, there's no transaction taking place. Today, if you hear his voice, harden not your heart. The gospel message has in it the grace to respond to the gospel message. And then winding up, the idea is, okay, God gives us free choice, but he's a just God. So what if we blow it and sin against him, and then we decide that we want to turn back to him, and he's a just God, which means he has to judge every sin. If God does not judge a sin, his silence would effectively be giving consent to sin. And if God gives consent to sin, he's no longer a just God. How many of you have been to wedding ceremonies? The pastor says, anybody against this wedding, speak now or forever hold your peace. If you're sitting in the chair silent, your silence is giving consent to the wedding. If there are sins going on and God is not judging those sins, his silence would effectively be giving consent to the sin. And if God gives consent to sin, he's no longer a just God. He denies his just nature. He denies himself. He ungods himself. He's kicked out of heaven. God, his very core nature is just. He is a God of law and order. He has to judge every sin. But in his plan of redemption, he provided the lamb to take the judgment for the sin. So Abraham and Isaac are going to the top of Mount Moriah. And Isaac says, Father, we have the wood for the sacrifice. We have the coals for the fire for the sacrifice. But where is the sacrifice? And Abraham says, Son, God will provide himself a sacrifice. And it has a double meaning. God will have a sacrifice, a ram up on the hill, right? Or God will provide himself as the sacrifice. And that's what happened. Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, the only begotten Son of God, the Word of God, became flesh. He became the lamb to take the judgment of God, the wrath of God that we deserve, that a just God has to judge the sin. But Jesus is the lamb that took the judgment in our place. You know, I was reading the book of Revelation, still trying to figure it out, but one thing seems clear. It's God that's pouring out the vials of judgment in the book of Revelation, right? The lamb breaks the seal, the angels throw the censer on, there's smoke, and the angels cry out, righteous and true are your judgments, O Lord. Why is that? That's the final judgment. So God has to judge every sin that he missed along the way so that for the rest of eternity, he doesn't have to do any more judging. But in that sense, Jesus had the book of Revelation judgment poured out on his head. He took the judgment for every sin that everybody would ever do upon himself on the cross. It says, a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years as a day. Jesus experienced that day of God's wrath for our sins upon himself as if it was 1,000 years. And I've got a degree in accounting, so I like things that balance. If you think of it as an equation, an eternal being, Jesus, who is innocent, suffering for a finite period of time, right? The day on the cross and the whatever happened those other 3 days. An eternal being who's innocent, suffering for a finite period of time, is equal to all of us finite beings who are guilty, suffering for an eternal period of time. Let me say that again. An eternal being who's innocent, suffering for a finite period of time, is equal to all of us finite beings who are guilty, suffering for an eternal period of time. Yes. Infinity times finite equals finite times infinity. Jesus literally suffered the equivalent of eternal damnation in all of our places. He is the only one that could have done it. And out of love for the Father and out of love for you and me, he sweat drops of blood. He became the lamb. He took the judgment for all. So God the Father can maintain the fact that he is a just God. He judges every sin. The accuser of the brethren is cast down. What's Satan? The name Satan means accuser. He accuses you to God. He says, God, you're a just God. You got to judge him. God said, I did in Jesus. Anyway. So tonight, if you've never 100% trusted in the Lamb, put all your faith in Jesus. We can approach the God that created time. He knows exactly what's going on right now. He knows what's going on, the dirty backroom deals. He knows all that stuff. And he decided for you to be alive right now. He's got a plan. But you know, I tell people God has plan A, plan B. Plan A is he blesses us. We turn to him out of gratefulness. If that doesn't work, there's plan B. He lets things get a little tough and we turn to him out of desperation. I mean, how many of you tend to pray more when things aren't going good? How many of you? And so, we need to pray all the time. But when there's a crisis, people turn to Christ. I think that, I got to stop. The same crises, the first prophecy was God told the serpent that the seed of the woman will crush your head, but you'll bruise his heel, right? And it happened simultaneously on the cross. The devil got the Jews and Gentiles to crucify Jesus and dust his hands. He goes, that's it. I took her to Christ. Jesus says, it's finished. What's finished? The Jews and Gentiles sacrificed the Lamb of God so that all of humanity now can approach this almighty, perfect, just God and not be judged for it because the Lamb took their place. The devil got his head crushed. It happened simultaneously. So the same crises that we're seeing that the world, the devil wants to use to get people into fear so he can usurp power and eventually set up his evil one world government, that same crisis is going to cause a whole lot of people to turn to Christ, and we're going to see a great end time revival. And your presence here tonight on a Wednesday night is proof of that. So I'm going to stop with that. God bless you.